Take your Bibles. Let's go to Ruth chapter 2. Might be thinking, oh, Ruth, huh? That's kind of interesting. Doug said it well last night. He said, the Old Testament is the New Testament concealed, and the New Testament is the Old Testament revealed, in a sense. And what I want to go over with you today is I want to talk to you about the Kinsman Redeemer. And when you want to talk about the Kinsman Redeemer, you go to the book of Ruth, right? And so, but what I want to do is I want to show you a little big love story. Because the book of Ruth is a little big love story. It's placed in the time of the judges, and which is a dark time. But in the middle of this time, God writes this book. He has this record written of Ruth, the Moabitess, and Boaz. And it's a little big love story because it's just this beautiful love story in the middle of a dark time. But it has big, broad applications, and we're going to get those. So we're going to look at this record of Ruth, and we're going to draw out some principles. We're going to look at the interactions between Ruth and Boaz, and then we're going to go into what does this mean for us? What's the point of having this love story in the middle of the Bible about these two people? All right, so you ready? Okay, cool. So we're going to talk about the Kinsman Redeemer. Let's go to Ruth chapter 1. I should get there. You're probably there before I am. And we're going to start in verse 1, and I'm going to move you through the book of Ruth, and we're going to take a little bit from every chapter. But my heart for you is that after I kind of place a little foundation for this, that you'll go back and read it, and you'll read it in detail and really see kind of hearts. God's heart beaming through it. So let's start in Ruth chapter 1, and we'll start in verse 1. And it says, now it came to pass in the days when the what? Judges ruled, that there was a certain famine in the land, and a certain man of Bethlehem, Judah, went to sojourn in the country of Moab, he and his wife and his two sons. And the name of the man was Elimelech, and the name of his wife Naomi, and the name of his two sons Mahlon and Chilion. Good Klingon names, right? Ephrathites of Bethlehem, Judah, and they came into the country of Moab and continued there. So we'll pause. Now it's the time of the judges. All right, so just go back one page to the last chapter of Judges. And let's read the last verse there. This is going to kind of encapsulate what the time of the judges is. It says in verse 25, in those days there was no king in Israel, and every man did that which was right in God's eyes? No, in his own eyes. This is what characterizes the time of judges. Judges is a time where a long interval of time, man did what was right in his own eyes. I mean, and it's a dark time in Israel's history. It's controversial. There's moral degeneracy. There's spiritual bankruptcy. There's idolatry. The house of Israel is usually going from one subjugation to another. People are coming and taking it over, holding it for a couple years. And then a judge rises up. God rises up a judge and saves them from utter catastrophe. But then really shortly after, they revert back to the old same stuff. And so this happens for a long period of time. And it's the backdrop of this story. And so these people are doing what's right in their own eyes rather than the eyes of the Lord. And then all of a sudden, the story of Ruth and Boaz comes out of nowhere, right? It's kind of interesting. Now, this certain man of Bethlehem, Judah, went to sojourn in the country of Moab, he and his wife and his two sons. So let's look at a little bit of the history of Moab with reference to the history of the children of Israel. Let's go to Numbers chapter 25. It says in Numbers chapter 25, verse 1, it says, and Israel abode in Shittim, and the people begun to commit whoredom with the daughters of what? Moab. So this is the history of Moab with Israel. In fact, if you really want to go back, Moab, it comes from an encounter that Lot had with his daughters. They got him drunk. They thought maybe they might have been the last people alive, and they wanted to sustain a posterity for their children. And so they ended up getting him drunk, sleeping with him, and they were two daughters who slept with him, and they both had one son from their father. Kind of Kind of bad background, huh? One of those sons' name was Ammon. The other's son was named Moab. All right? And it said, and that's the record in Genesis 19. And it says that they will be bitter enemies of the descendants of Abraham. And they end up going to war with the descendants of Abraham in the book of Samuel and the book of Chronicles. And so there's history there is what I'm trying to get at. So this man, Elimelech, he is going to leave Bethlehem, Judah, because there's a famine in the land, right? It's Judges, controversial time, hard time. There's a famine in the land. And so he ends up wanting to leave, possibly for the prospect of being able to live through the famine. Maybe he got a job offer. We don't really know. But he decides to leave Bethlehem, Judah. Now, the name of Bethlehem means the house of bread. And the name Judah means the house of praise. And so this man is going to leave the house of bread and the house of praise, maybe with the best of intentions, but he's going to leave to a place called Moab. And it's got a history in Moab, right? Let's look a little more at Moab. Let's go to Deuteronomy chapter 23. And it says in Deuteronomy chapter 23, would anybody like to read? Joe, you want to read verse 3 for me, please?
"And Ammonite or Moabite shall not enter into the congregation of the Lord, even to the tenth generation shall they not enter into the congregation of the Lord."
Go on and read till verse 4 and 5.
"Because they met you not with bread, with water in the way, when ye came forth out of Egypt, and because they hired against thee Balaam the son of Beor of Methor of Mesopotamia to curse thee. Nevertheless, the Lord thy God would not hearken unto Balaam, but the Lord thy God turned the curse into a blessing unto thee, because thy Lord loved thee."
Awesome. So more history. The Moab, under the law, Moabite can't enter the congregation of Israel for 10 generations. In fact, 10 actually might be a metaphorical means for like ever, because it says in the congregation of thy Lord forever. That's the end of verse 3. And so this is the history of Moab. And this is why Elimelech, maybe with good intentions, might be doing something that's a little kind of backwards. He might have the good intentions, but he's taking his wife. He's taking his two sons. He's leading them into a land that his wife will have no godly friends. These are Moabitess women, right? His sons will have no godly potentials for marriage because they're in Moab. And there's no synagogue there, as far as I know through study, where they can worship the one true God, right? And so Elimelech might have these good intentions, but if you really think about it, I mean, what is he leading his family into? And they end up having a pretty tragic closure to Elimelech. Verse 3 in Ruth chapter 1, go back there. Says in verse 3, "And Elimelech, Naomi's husband, died. She was left and her two sons. They took them wives of the women of Moab, and the name of the one was Orpah, and the name of the other is Ruth. And they dwelled there about 10 years. And then Mahlon and Chilion died also, both of them. And the woman was left of her two sons and her husband. And then she arose with her daughters-in-law, that she might return from the country of Moab. For she had heard in the country of Moab how the Lord had visited his people in giving them bread." So they go to Moab, 10 years, bad story. It doesn't work out for them. Doesn't work out. They have a hard time. Mahlon and Chilion die. Naomi's husband Elimelech died. So now Naomi has these two Moabitess daughters-in-laws, and they are fatherless, and they're widows. Fatherless and widows are probably some of the most pitied people in the Bible. In fact, if you read James chapter 1:27, you don't have to turn there. I'll just tell you what it says. It says that pure religion and undefiled is this: to visit the fatherless and the widows in their affliction, and to keep yourself unspotted from the world. And so the fatherless and the widows were actually really pitied. And so what you could really see in Ruth and Naomi and this girl Orpah is that they are like bottom rung, right? This is like rock bottom for them, right? They don't have their security blanket. Their husbands aren't there to provide. They don't. And right now they're homeless and they're destitute. But the Lord has visited his people. the Lord has visited Bethlehem, Judah in the time of Ruth. And so during this famine, you have this backdrop, you have a glimmer of hope because the Lord has visited his people and the famine is being lifted. They hear about this in Moab, and so they're going to take the three-week journey by foot from Moab back to Bethlehem, and there they're going to look for better prospects. Why? Because the Lord has visited his people. Okay. Let's skip on over to verse 15. In walking over to Bethlehem, Judah, Naomi pretty much tries to release her daughters from their obligation of taking care of her. She says, look, we're widows, and your father's gone. Go back to your lands. Go back to your gods. You might have better prospects of marriage there. Don't stay with me. Even if I had sons today and raise them up, would you wait for them to become of age so that you could marry them? She tries to release them from this obligation of taking care of her. One that Orpah actually, she says, okay, I'm going to take your advice, Ma. And she does, she leaves. But Ruth stays. Let's see, in verse 8, actually. Or verse 15, sorry. It says, and she said, behold, thy sister-in-law, this is Naomi talking, is gone back unto her people and unto her gods. Return thou after thy sister-in-law. Ruth said, entreat me not to leave thee or to return from following after thee. For where you go, I'll go. And where you lodge, I will lodge. Thy people shall be my people and thy what? Thy God, my God. So this is Ruth saying, the life with Moab is done. The life with that place, all that it represents, it's God's everything. Now your God is my God, and I will follow you. And this is a Naomi and Ruth both are pretty fantastic people in this record. Verse 17, where thou diest will I die, and there will I be buried. The Lord do so to me, and more also, if nothing but death part thee and me. And when she saw that she was steadfastly minded to go with her, then she left speaking unto her. So they two went until they came to Bethlehem. And it came to pass, when they were come to Bethlehem, that all the city was moved about them, and they said, is this Naomi? So they've been gone for 10 years. But when she comes back, they remember Naomi. They remember, oh, well, you're back. What are you doing here? Verse 20, and she said unto them, call me not Naomi, which means pleasant. Call me Mara, which means bitter. For the Almighty hath dealt very bitterly with me. So Naomi thinks that perhaps this is the hand of the Lord gone out against her. To which I respond, you left. You know, he was still there. You left. But it's interesting. Imagine walking into like a social event. And you know they have like the hello, my name is. Right? The tags. And then you meet a person. Oh, what's your name? Oh, hello, my name is bitter old woman. That's who I am. That's what she's saying. Verse 21, I went out full, and the Lord brought me home again empty. Why then call you me Naomi, seeing the Lord has testified against me, and the Almighty has afflicted me? Naomi thinks this is from God, but we'll see how this plays out. So Naomi returned, and Ruth the Moabitess, her daughter-in-law, with her, which returned out of the country of Moab, and they came to Bethlehem in the beginning of the barley harvest. So really, chapter 1 of Ruth is about famine. Not just geographical famine. It's about financial famine. It's about parental famine. No sons anymore, right? It's about marital famine. No wives, no husbands. Yeah. It's about famine across. It's about meaning and purpose famine. It's about famine. But there's one glimmer of hope in Ruth. The Lord has visited his people. So where the Lord's inclusion is, he can bring life into lifeless places. So let's see what happens in Ruth chapter 2. And you might be thinking, what's the point of us doing this? Hold on, don't worry, we're setting the stage. Ruth chapter 2. And I wonder, when Naomi was talking about how she came back empty, was Ruth standing there? Right? I wonder if Ruth was standing there. Because this time between Israel and Moab, the history is fresh. You know, the things that happened, I mean, this is clear indication to Israel. They know their laws. They know that it was Moab in the wilderness that led some of the children into whoredom. They know the background of Moab. No people shall enter the congregation from Moab. They know all this stuff. And so Naomi leaves, and she comes back, and she's like, not only am I empty, but I have this Moabitess daughter-in-law with me, right? This is like the lowest of the low. I tried to tell her to leave. She didn't leave. Chapter 2, verse 1. Naomi had a kinsman of her husband's, a mighty man of wealth of the family of Elimelech. And his name was what? Boaz. The name Boaz means strong. Is a strong man. It also means in him is strength. That's another definition. So if you want to look at what a strong man looks like, if you want to look at what it means to be a strong man, Boaz is a good example. You can look at his character, look at his interactions, look at how he dealt with situations, how he treated people, and you'll see what a strong man looks like. In fact, where it says a mighty man of wealth in the KJV, that word wealth is actually the word kail, which is actually the word a mighty man of valor. Right, and so when you think of that, you might be thinking David's mighty men of valor. You might be thinking of these great captains, these great men of wherewithal, of purpose, who know how to fight and lead. Well, Boaz is one of those type of guys. Verse 2, and Ruth the Moabitess said unto Naomi, let me now go to the field, glean ears of corn after him in whose sight I shall find grace. And she said unto her, go, my daughter. And she went, and she just so happened to land on a part of the field belonging unto Boaz, who is the kindred of Elimelech. All right, so at this time, those who were farmers, and this is kind of like a social assistance program that was put in the Bible. If you were a farmer and you had a harvest of a field, the margins of the field, the ends of the field around the field were left for the marginalized. So the poor could come over there, they could glean, it was called gleaning. And you would leave that for them, and it was a way to command the affluent to be generous and to command those who are inactive and possibly poor to give them a dignified way to provide for themselves, okay? And so that was the purpose of this. And so she's referencing this. Hopefully I find some person who, in whose eyes I get grace, and they'll allow me to glean out of their fields, okay? Verse 4. Behold, Boaz came from Bethlehem and said unto the reapers, the Lord be with you. And they answered him, the Lord bless thee. This is the first instance where Boaz is brought into the scene. And he's a boss. And his first interaction is with his employees. And he says, God bless you. And all of them in unison say back to him, God bless you. What an awesome boss. You want a boss like that? I want a boss like that. I think I kind of have a boss like that. Aaron's like that. We say that to each other all the time. I want to be a boss like that. Immediately you can see he commands respect and his people love him and he loves his people. Immediately, off the cuff, okay? Verse 8. Then said Boaz unto Ruth. And so Boaz sees Ruth, sees that she's gleaning, and he says this. Hear thou not, my daughter. Go not to glean in another field, neither go from hence, but abide here fast by my maidens. Let thine eyes be on the field that they do reap, and go thou after them. Have not I charged the young men that they shall not touch you? And when you are athirst, go unto the vessels, and drink of that which the young men have drawn. So his first interaction with Ruth is, stay here, stay in my field. Don't go in any other field. Because back in those times, some guys, you know, even though it was commanded by the law, it was almost seen as a grace. And if they saw people gleaning in their field, sometimes they'd beat them up because they're thinking that they're stealing from their prophets, right? Get out of my field. This is my stuff, not yours. Get out. And so Boaz is trying to protect her. Boaz is protecting Ruth. And he says, don't go in any other field. Stay in mine. And guess what? Stay with my maidens. Stay with my maidens. That way you'll look like one of us. And my men, I've commanded them, nobody's going to touch you. Nobody's going to touch you. You're going to be safe. You're going to be protected here. This is for you. You stay in this field, no other field. Now contrast what Boaz does with what Elimelech did. Immediately Boaz enters her into community. Immediately Boaz gives her godly friends, women to befriend, the maidens in the field, and immediately gives her godly men who'll keep their hands to themselves but still protect her. He immediately brings her into a community that she can find and that she can be safe and protected in. Contrast that with Elimelech. Good intentions. But he ended up leaving the house of bread, leaving the house of praise, and having no community. You know, I mean, forsake not the assembling of ourselves together is an important role in what we do. Hebrews chapter 10, right? Why? Because there's protection in the community of God. There's protection in the flock. And hopefully, this is ideal. The ideal is that we'll have good men and women of God, men who will know how to keep their hands to themselves and be able to conduct themselves with women and as sisters of Christ first, and good women of God, when they see somebody who is poor, who is destitute, who is on the outside, who is a foreigner, they see her and they say, "We'll protect you. You stay in this field." Imagine that. And that's Boaz right off the rip. What a great guy, right? That's awesome. And so she's working. Let's continue on to 10 through 13. "Then she fell on her face and bowed herself to the ground and said unto him, 'Why have I found grace in thine eyes, that thou should take knowledge of me, seeing I am a stranger?' And Boaz answered and said unto her, 'It has been fully showed me all that you have done unto thy mother, Naomi, since the death of thine husband, and how thou hast left thy father and thy mother and the land of thy nativity, and art come unto a people which thou knewest not heretofore. The Lord recompense thy work.'" You know, she might have been doing these things in secret. You know, she's on a hard one. I mean, last 10 years of her life have been pretty tough. Lost a dad, lost a husband, lost a sister. Orpah's gone, right? Mama's homeless. She's homeless. You know, and a lot, and kindness will go really far in this type of situation. And Boaz gives that to her. And she says, "Why have I found grace in thy sight?" Verse 13. Verse 12, Boaz says, "The Lord recompense thy work, and a full reward be given thee of the Lord God of Israel, under whose wings thou art come to trust." Boaz had heard of her devotion to Naomi. He had heard of her godly character and her godly conduct, even being a Moabitish woman. So she's really in the house of Israel. She's like a second-class citizen. But he says, "I've heard of this. I've respected this. You might do things in secret, and you might think that nobody's watching. But God says, you know, you pray to me in secret, I'm going to reward you openly. You live for me in the inner part of your heart, I'm going to reward you openly." And I want to use this as a principle to show you that what you do in secret, people see. And what you do in secret, God sees. And if you've come to trust in under the wings of God, the Lord's going to recompense your work. And this is a record of the Lord doing that, really, for Ruth and for Boaz. Now, think about this. Boaz is affluent. He's rich. She's a Moabitish woman. Culturally, their background is whoredom. That's how they did that to the children of Israel before, right? But there's no indication of Boaz trying to be kind in a way that garners himself some type of reward, if you know what I'm talking about, if you follow me. And there's no indication, because I'm sure there is a temptation, which there is culturally today for many women, to put themselves forward in a certain way in order to get security, right? To put themselves, to sell out in a certain way. This is a huge thing. I deal with this with young women all the time. And there's a huge temptation to do that, but is there any indication that Ruth is doing this? Absolutely not. These are two righteous people. Two righteous people who are going against the cultural norms of the day because they love God. Right? This one is giving a hand to the needy and to the destitute. The other one is not backing down on her morals. A new convert, Ruth, new convert, not backing down from her morals, not backing down from serving her God. And she's going to do this the right way, even if it's the hard way. It's pretty cool, huh? Verse 13, "Then she said, 'Let me find favor in thy sight, my Lord, for thou hast comforted me, for that thou hast spoken friendly unto thine handmaid, and though I be not like unto one of your own handmaids.'" A little kindness probably goes a long way for Ruth right now. Let's go to verse 17. "So she gleaned in the field until even, and beat out that she had gleaned, and it was about an ephah of barley, which is about 5.5 pounds of barley. This was a lot. This is a lot of food. And she gleaned well. And she took it up and went into the city, and her mother-in-law, Naomi, saw what she had gleaned, and she brought forth and gave to her that she had reserved after she sufficed. And her mother-in-law said unto her, where have you gleaned today? Where wrought thou? Blessed be he that did take knowledge of thee. And she showed her mother-in-law with whom she had wrought, and said, the man's name with whom I wrought today is Boaz. And Naomi said unto her daughter-in-law, blessed be he of the Lord, who has not left off his kindness to the living and to the dead. And Naomi said unto her, the man is near of kin to us, one of our next kinsmen. Anybody got the ESV here? All right, well, I'll just tell you what it says in the ESV. It says, he is our redeemer. That's what it says, okay? And this is interesting, right? Because Naomi, just a chapter before, was like, the Lord has afflicted me. You know, everything was so terrible. And all of a sudden, she's like, oh, joy, Boaz, the next kinsman. Why is she saying this? Well, let's see a couple of things. There is a responsibilities for the kinsman redeemer, it's called. And so let's look at a couple of these responsibilities. What does the kinsman redeemer do? Let's go to Leviticus chapter 25. Says in Leviticus chapter 25, verse 47, if a sojourner or a stranger wax rich by thee, and thy brother that dwells by him wax poor, and sells himself unto the stranger or the sojourner, or to the stock of the stranger or foreigner's family, after that he is sold, he may be what? Redeemed again. One of his brethren may redeem him, buy him back. One duty of the kinsman redeemer is to buy back his family from slavery. Okay? Leviticus 25, verse 25 says, if thy brother be waxen poor, and has sold away some of his possessions, and if any of his kin come to redeem it, then shall he redeem it, that which his brother sold. So the responsibility of a kinsman redeemer is also to buy back land that was forfeited by the family. Deuteronomy 25, let's go there. And this is the one that Naomi is particularly excited about. Deuteronomy chapter 25 says in verse 5, if brethren dwell together, and one of them die and have no child, the wife of the dead shall not marry without outside unto a foreigner. Her husband's brother, and that word in the Hebrew is actually her next kinsman, shall go into her and take her to him to wife, and perform the duty of a husband's brother unto her. And it shall be that the firstborn which she bears shall succeed in the name of his brother which is dead, that his name be not put out of Israel. So God is very, very interested in preserving the family. So much so that it was commanded that the brother of a deceased brother who has a wife, an obligation for the next kinsman is to take that wife, marry her, perform the duty of a husband, and raise the children up in the name of the first husband. Because God wanted that name to stay forever in the house of Israel. In fact, if you flip the coin, God is a really harsh judgment that God will do on somebody who does something really heinous in the Old Testament, as he says, I'm going to wipe off the remembrance of them off the face of the earth forever. And what that means is their genealogy stops with that person. Posterity no more. Flip it on the other side of the coin. God is really, really, really interested in encouraging the family of God. He's given us an eternal posterity. It's called everlasting life. And so God is very interested in the family. That's one of his hearts. He's very interested in the family. All right? Verse 7. And if the man like not to take his brother's wife, then let his brother's wife go up to the gate unto the elders and say, my husband's brother refuses to raise up unto his brother a name in Israel. He will not perform the duty of the next kinsman. Then the elders of his city shall call him and speak unto him, And if he stand to it and say, I like not to take her, then shall his brother's wife come unto him in the presence of the elders and loose his shoe from off his foot and spit in his face and shall answer and say, so shall it be done unto that man that will not build up his brother's house. And his name shall be called in Israel, the house of him that has his shoe loosed. Burn. That's a Jewish burn. Okay? So, that's what you get called. You get a man with his shoe loosed, and that's what you're labeled forever after that. All right? So, obviously, this was important to God in the commandment. Okay? So, this is what Naomi is thinking of when she says, Boaz, he's our kinsman redeemer. He could do this for us. We're poor, we're destitute, we're homeless. He's shown favor to you. This guy could fulfill this obligation. He could do this. We have a glimmer of hope. He could bring us out of bondage, pretty much. All right? And the thing about this, and this is where it starts to turn over. Because Boaz is a type for Jesus. Boaz is a figure for Jesus Christ. What Jesus Christ did is Jesus Christ is our kinsman redeemer. And what did he do? He purchased his family back from slavery. The slavery of sin and bondage. What did he do? He's going to buy the land back. When he comes back to the restitution of all things, he's coming back for the rightful claim to the land. And even in marriage, in the book of Corinthians, it tells us that we're to marry in the Lord only and we're to raise up children in the name of our brethren, Jesus Christ. So Jesus Christ operates this for us. Remember when Doug said, and I referenced it today, the Old Testament is the New Testament concealed, the New Testament is the Old Testament revealed. What God is doing with the story of Ruth is hiding the story of redemption in plain sight. It's like the Old Testament is written in a certain type of code. And in order to crack that code, you need Christ and you need the New Testament. But then after you see Christ, after you have the New Testament, you can look back and be like, man, you hid this in plain sight. What Boaz does for Ruth is exactly what Jesus Christ does for us. Isn't that amazing? God's pretty smart, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah, he's pretty smart. So in chapter 3, for the sake of time, I'll just tell you what happens in chapter 3. Naomi says, okay, Ruth, the only time he's ever seen you is you've been dirty, picking in a field, your hair's been up, you've been sun-parched, sweaty, and smelly. Make yourself look nice and go and propose to him. That's pretty much chapter 3, okay? Chapter 3 is go to the threshing floor because they were harvesting the fields. Remember, the Lord visited his people. Bread's coming back into the house of bread, right? Bread is coming back to the people, and then what they do after the harvest is they have like a work party on the threshing floor. They eat and they drink, and they distribute and separate the excess of the wheat on the threshing floor, and they get the quality stuff, bound it up, get it ready for the town gate, get it ready for distribution, okay? So that's what they do on the threshing floor. Naomi tells Ruth, okay, what I want you to do is I want you to go there, and he's going to sleep on the threshing floor because he's going to protect the threshing floor from anybody else coming, right? Because there's a famine in the land, right? So you want to protect your property. And so she's like, he's going to sleep on the threshing floor. I want you to make yourself nice, make yourself presentable, and then I want you to go and do a proposal to him. And she does do it. It's really hard not to read any of chapter 3 right now and go off on a couple tears because it's such a beautiful, romantic situation. It's just really gorgeous. But you're just going to have to read it later, okay? And so they do that, but Boaz says, I would love to redeem you, but there is a nearer kinsman. So he's a relative, but he's a distant relative. And the way that it happened in the law is the nearest kinsman is the one who gets the priority of redemption. Okay? So that's what brings us into chapter 4. Let's start in chapter 4. What do you do, Boaz? Ruth chapter 4, verse 1 says, then went Boaz up to the gate and sat him down there, and behold, the kinsman of whom Boaz spake came by, meaning the nearer kinsman, right, to Naomi and Ruth, unto whom he said, ho, such a one, turn aside, sit here, turn aside, and sat down. Verse 2, took 10 men of the elders of the city. So what he's doing here is a legal transaction. He's making this legal, all right? He's like, I need witnesses, I need people at the gate, we're going to make this a legal transaction. Verse 3, and he said unto the kinsman Naomi, that has come again out of the country of Moab. Oh, and he said unto the kinsman, Naomi, that has come again out of the country of Moab, sells a parcel of land, which was our brother Elimelech's. And I thought to advertise thee, saying, buy it before the inhabitants and before the elders of my people. If you will redeem it, redeem it. But if you will not redeem it, then tell me that I may know. For there is none to redeem it besides me, and I am after thee. And he, the other kinsman, said, I'm going to do it. I'll redeem it. And so this is Boaz saying, look, you have priority in the law. So please tell me if you're not going to redeem it, because I'll take care of it. And he's talking about the land, right? And so look at his sly work right here, verse 5. Then said Boaz, what day thou buyest the field of the hand of Naomi, thou must buy it also of Ruth the Moabitess, the wife of the dead, to raise up the name of the dead upon his inheritance. He says, oh, you want the land? Then you got to take the girl too, the Moabitess woman. Ooh, right? Verse 6. And the kinsman said, I cannot redeem it. I cannot redeem it for myself, lest I mar mine own inheritance. Redeem thou right to thyself, for I cannot redeem it. That was quick, huh? Verse 7. Now this was the manner in former time in Israel concerning redeeming and concerning changing. For to confirm all things, a man what? Plucked off his shoe and gave it to his neighbor, and this was the testimony in Israel. Therefore the kinsman said unto Boaz, buy it for thee. So he drew off his shoe. So this man is going through the proper channels of the law. He's doing it the law's way, right? Except for the whole spit in the face thing, right? Verse 9. And Boaz said unto the elders and unto all the people, you are witnesses this day that I have bought all that was Elimelech's and that was Chilion's and Mahlon's and of the hand of Naomi. Moreover, Ruth the Moabitess, the wife of Mahlon, have I purchased to be my wife, to raise up in the name of the dead upon his inheritance, that the name of the dead be not cut off from among his brethren and from the gate of his place. You are witnesses this day. And all the people that were in the gate and the elders said, we are witnesses. The Lord make the woman that has come into thine house like Rachel and like Leah, which too did build the house of Israel, and do thou worthily in Ephratah, and be famous in Bethlehem. Boaz, purchases her, buys her back. You know, Ruth had everything going against her. Everything going against her. She's got the wrong family line. Incest, right? She's got the wrong history. She's got the wrong spiritual background. They did Baal worship, and they worshiped the false god Chemosh in Moab. She's got the wrong lineage. She's got the wrong culture. They're known for whoredom. She's got the wrong everything. Everything is wrong. But she puts God first. She's an amazing believer. And Boaz, amazing man, says, that one, I want that one to be my wife. Verse 13. So Boaz took Ruth, and she was his wife. And when he went in unto her, the Lord gave her conception, and she bare a son. And the woman said unto Naomi, blessed be the Lord, which hath not let thee this day without a kinsman, that his name may be famous in Israel. And he shall be unto thee a restorer of thy life, a nourisher of thine old age, for thy daughter-in-law, which loves thee, which is better to thee than seven sons, has borne him. And Naomi took the child, laid it in her bosom, and became nurse to it. And the woman, her neighbors, gave it a name, saying, there is a son born to Naomi. They called his name Obed. He is the father of Jesse, the father of who? David. God uses a Moabitish woman outside of the house of Israel. Never can get in, really. Can't get in under the law, right? Can't get in because no Moabitess comes into the congregation of Israel 10 generations, which really I think is a metaphorical statement for forever, because it says that at the end of verse 3 in Deuteronomy chapter 25. And he uses her, this one, in order to bring about the Christ line. This is David's great-grandma. Verse 18. Now these are the generations of Perez. Perez begot Hezron. Hezron begat Ram. Ram begat Amminadab. Amminadab begat Nahshon. Nahshon begat Salmon. Salmon begat Boaz. Boaz begat Obed. Obed begat Jesse. And Jesse begat David. Now this is the cool part of this, because you might be thinking, okay, great, great bunch of names. Whatever. But if you count the number of generations that are listed here, you know how much there are? 10. There's 10 generations. Now, I think that this is God's response to the 10 generations in Deuteronomy chapter 25 about them not being able to come in because they're cursed. 10 generations up until forever can't come in unless you get married in. Unless a kinsman redeemer comes and gets you in. Now, look at this. I mean, now let's go back. We already read it. Let's go back to Deuteronomy chapter 23. And Joey Seed, you want to read verse 3 through 5?
Deuteronomy 23, verses 3 through 5.
Yeah.
And if the latter husband hater and writer of bill of divorcement.
Oh, wrong one. Deuteronomy 23?
Oh, that was 24, sorry.
Yep. That's a different topic.
Yeah. All right, 23, verses 3 through 5. Ammonite or Moabite shall not enter into the congregation of the Lord, even to their tenth generation shall they not enter into the congregation of the Lord forever. Because they met you not with bread and with water in the way, and you came forth out of Egypt, because they hired against thee Balaam, the son of Beor of Pethor, of Mesopotamia, to curse thee. Nevertheless, the Lord thy God would not hearken unto Balaam, but the Lord thy God turned a curse into a blessing unto thee, because the Lord thy God loved thee.
Awesome. So 10 generations can't go in, but the God, our God, is into turning curses into blessings. And all of a sudden, 10 generations later, the Moabites is having David. Our God is about turning curses into blessings. And this is, you might have brought this, this might be the obvious point already, is that the kinsman redeemer, that's what Jesus Christ does for us. Boaz is a type for the kinsman redeemer. In fact, in the temple, one of the pillars of the temple, when they built it, was to be described with the name Boaz. Goodness. But what is equally impactful is, we are Ruth. We come from the wrong background. We come from the wrong heritage. We have the wrong cultural background. Spiritually, we were defunct at one point. We come from a place of moral degeneracy and controversy and darkness. We were in that. And we brought nothing to the table. But once we made thy God our God, like Ruth did for Naomi, God came and he provided a kinsman redeemer for those who needed it. And just like Ruth, it was impossible for us to get into the house of God by the law. We couldn't do it. Now, it might be a different stipulation of the law, but it's still the same. We couldn't do it by the law. But God sent Jesus Christ to come and redeem us. That's grace. And so we get to say to God, just like Ruth said to Boaz, what have I done to find grace in your sight? We came from a dark place, but God redeemed us back through Jesus Christ. Can we get some praise for God for Jesus Christ real quick? Hallelujah. Let's go to 1 Peter, and we'll draw to a close. 1 Peter 1:9. He had this story of redemption hiding in plain sight. And this, that's why it's a little big love story. It's about Ruth and Boaz, which is romantic and beautiful, and there's lots to draw from it, great principles, but it's a story of Jesus Christ and his church. First Peter chapter 1, verse 19. It says, but with, 18, for as much as you know that you were not redeemed, bought back with corruptible things, as silver and gold from your vain conversation received by tradition from your father. You know, Boaz redeemed Ruth with substance. Jesus Christ redeemed us with blood, with himself, everything. Verse 19, but with the precious blood of Christ as a lamb without blemish and without spot. Ephesians chapter 2. Ephesians chapter 2, verse 11 says, wherefore remember that you were in times past Moabites, Gentiles, in the flesh, who are called uncircumcision by that which is called the circumcision in the flesh made by hands. That at that time you were without Christ, being aliens from the commonwealth of Israel, and strangers from the covenant of promise, having absolutely no hope without God in the world. But now, in Christ Jesus, you who are sometimes afar off are made near by the blood. For he is our peace, who has made both one, hath broken down the middle wall of partition between us, verse 15, having abolished in his flesh the enmity, even the law of commandments contained in ordinances, for to make in himself of twain one new man, so making peace. You know, it's interesting. Boaz loved Ruth, but he did it by the law, right? He even gave the next kinsman priority. So he loved God, and he did it the right way. Jesus Christ loved us, but he had to fulfill the law in order to get it out the way so that we can be brought in. I mean, look at these parallels. Verse 16, and that he might reconcile both unto God in one body by the cross, having slain the enmity thereby, and came and preached peace to you which were afar off and to them that were nigh. For through him we both have access by one Spirit unto the Father. Now, therefore, you are no more strangers and foreigners. You're no more Moabites, but fellow citizens with the saints and of the house of God. God had a little big love story for us. And what I want you to walk away with from this is a little bit about the character of Ruth and Boaz, both of them awesome, principled, beautiful people. But I want you to take the story of redemption, how God has hid this in the book of Ruth for people to know, hid it in plain sight. And then Jesus comes on the scene, boom, and then all of a sudden it's got weightier depth. I also want us to just be very, very, very thankful for our kinsman redeemer, because we were them. We were the homeless, destitute, spiritually bankrupt, morally degenerate, all that stuff. That was a perfect representation of exactly who we were before Christ. But we got redeemed and we got brought in. And this is the call to arms. Pure religion is this, and undefiled, that you visit the fatherless, them without a heavenly father, and the widows, them without a husband, Jesus Christ, in their affliction, and that you keep yourself unspotted from the world. Now that we've been redeemed, we got the ministry of reconciliation, and we get to go and do that same thing. We get to introduce them to Jesus Christ, give them a heavenly father, give them a husband, and introduce them to the kinsman redeemer. That is what I have for you. I love you guys. God bless you. Woo.